So we've talked then about the CDC's action. We've talked about the implications for state and local governments here in the U.S. And now I'm going to talk about the global implications of this going forward. My organization, Occupational Knowledge International, works globally on environmental health threats. And about half our work concerns lead in one form or another. And we've been tracking this problem on the global level for many years. I'll be talking about that experience and talking about how the disparities that we see in the U.S. fit into the disparities we see globally. No relationships to disclose? Great. So this idea about going to a reference value has some other messaging that we should note. The message that I think this puts out is that there's no safe or acceptable level of exposure to children. Instead, all we could do is tell you about your son or daughter's exposure in relationship to other kids in the population. And of course, in our case, we're talking about the U.S. population, which is maybe the only country that has a national survey of blood lead levels that's regularly updated. And so we have the luxury of being able to do that. But clearly, we're not able to say what the top 2.5% of the kids are globally, because there is no global data. And so this tells people that, look, we're now concerned with all blood lead levels, and therefore our goal is to limit all lead exposures to children. And as Dave mentioned, we're talking about 500,000 children in the U.S. That are now exceeding this current reference value. But if we look at it globally, the problem is much, much greater. And even within the U.S., we know that this 500,000 children or so are not equally distributed in the population, but that low-income and minority populations are at much, much greater risk for having an elevated blood lead level. And this is for several reasons, including the fact that we know that low-income households are more likely to have a lead-based paint hazards than higher-income households. So we know that housing condition is one of the factors, but certainly not the only one. And this disparity between race and blood lead levels has been apparent for a long time in the NHANES data. This shows the disparity between non-Hispanic blacks and other race ethnicities based on the geometric blood lead level. And you could see, even though both are trending down, there's still a considerable gap. Similarly, if we look at income and geometric mean blood lead level, we see there are significant and long-standing gaps. And if we were to have better data from developing countries, wealthier countries and poorer countries, we would see that there's probably even a greater disparity between kids here in the U.S. and kids in the rest of the world. And I could say that because there have been limited studies published pretty regularly from China, India, and most other African regions of the world that have shown blood lead levels that are on order of 10 to 20 times higher than levels we see in kids in the U.S. So globally, the World Health Organization estimates that 240 million people have blood lead levels over 5 micrograms per deciliter. So you could see the U.S. is a very small part of this huge global epidemic. And if we look at the highest exposed, those above 20 micrograms per deciliter, 99% of those folks reside in developing countries. So this is a huge problem, and it's a growing threat, despite the success we've had in taking lead out of gasoline. Where currently there's only 5 or 6 countries that still use lead in gasoline for cars. That has been a huge success, but it's certainly not enough. This has led many to believe that lead poisoning is the most significant environmental health threat to children and perhaps to adults. but it's also one that's completely avoidable without waiting for any new treatments or new technologies. So why are developing countries more susceptible? Well, for one, there's more opportunity for exposure. Nutrition plays a huge role in lead absorption, and so that's clearly a linkage. And we also know that developing countries have a much higher proportion of children than developed countries. And then there's a lack of infrastructure for battery collection and proper recycling. And we also know that there's no health screening programs. Many countries have no laboratories that do blood lead testing at all. And there's been a growth in lead-containing products, and chief amongst those continues to be lead in paint. Now, there has been a really dramatic lead poisoning incident that has occurred over the last 2 or 3 years in Nigeria, in northern Nigeria, in a state called Zamfara. And there, Doctors Without Borders literally stumbled upon a childhood lead poisoning outbreak in 2010. They were in this area of the country doing vaccinations and found that a lot of new graves of very young children. And so with some investigation, they were able to determine the source of the lead exposure was from the gold ore being processed in and around homes. And this has led to somewhere around 450 to 500 deaths in this one state in northern Nigeria. And in some cases, that represented 25% of the children under age 5 in some of the villages that they looked at. And to this day, there are literally hundreds of children that are going on repeated chelation therapy. In some cases, they've had more than a dozen repeated chelation therapies just to keep these kids alive, and we know they're going to be severely impacted for life. Well, our organization was called in by the Ministry of Mines to do an investigation in other areas of the country to see if this contamination, this ore that contains lead, might also contain gold in other areas where gold processing is taking place. So we tested soil and looked for lead in various gold mining regions, and we did find other locations outside of Zamfara where the levels were as high as 10,000 parts per million in the gold ore. And we also found some mercury contamination, particularly where our mercury amalgam was taking place, but that was no surprise. And of course, we found significant child labor in these processing activities. And this is an example of the kind of conditions we saw on the ground. This is taking the rock and first grinding it and into very fine dust or powder. And in the process, of course, these exposures are extremely high. Because the ore has about 10% lead, you could be sure that these workers are very highly exposed to lead. But, of course, this is also a significant source of silica exposure. Now, the work of the ACLIP committee and the CDC, as I said, did not happen in a vacuum. In the last 3 or 4 years, the World Health Organization has come out saying there's no safe level. California EPA did a risk assessment looking at low-level impacts. The German government acted, and the National Toxicology Program have also issued reports about low-level impacts. So with all of this bad news, you would think that lead consumption would be going down. But instead, what we find is that there's been actually a big increase in global lead production over the past 15 years. And this is not even counting the recycled lead that's coming back into circulation, which would make this even more dramatic increase in terms of the lead consumption. This is a far cry from, let's say, asbestos, where the peak year for asbestos was 20 or 30 years ago globally, and it's been on the decline ever since. That's not the case with lead. So as we said in the past, the primary concern was lead additives in gasoline. Today, we're pretty much fighting for the last few rogue nations to change their ways, North Korea, Afghanistan, and all the U.S. Friendly countries like Iraq and Afghanistan are on that bad boys list. And here in the U.S., we're still trying to get lead out of the aviation fuel for propeller planes. But today, the primary sources we're looking at are products, including paints, and stationary sources, primarily lead smelters, lead battery recyclers, and battery manufacturing facilities. So why are we emphasizing lead batteries? Because over 80% of global lead consumption goes into making batteries. And this is the only rapidly growing segment of lead use globally, because lead batteries are in demand not just for vehicles, your cars, your trucks, your motorcycles, but they're also used in electric vehicles. In China, there are over 100 million electric vehicles, all dependent on lead batteries. These batteries last about a year and have to be recycled, and each one is about the size of the lead battery in your car. They're also used in every cell phone tower in the world, and they're also used for backup power and server farms. This is a photo I took of a child taking apart a truck battery in New Delhi, and you could see this taking place pretty much in every developing country in the world. The acid is thrown out on the street, the battery plates are separated out, these will be melted down and sold for scrap. And it's not just the recycling that's a problem, but also the manufacturing. The picture on the left was published by Alice Hamilton and a publication 100 years ago called Lead Poisoning and the Manufacture of Storage Batteries. I took the picture on the right, and I've seen it in dozens of lead battery plants around the world. This is state-of-the-art today. He's welding with a pure, almost pure lead rod onto almost pure lead battery plates. To better quantify this situation globally, we did a study along with my co-author, Amod Pokrel, in the second row, and I have copies of the study at the back chair you could grab on the way out. We did a review of all published studies in developing countries, limited to developing countries, looking at the period of 1993 to the year 2010. And found that average blood lead levels in battery manufacturing was around 47 micrograms per deciliter, so right around the level in the U.S. by which you would be removed under the OSHA guidelines. And in recycling, it's 64 micrograms per deciliter. And these are studies from approximately 37 different countries. We also found that average air lead levels were 367 micrograms per cubic meter. For you industrial hygienists, we're hitting some high levels here for sure. It's about seven times the OSHA PEL. And the geometric mean blood level of kids residing in close proximity to these plants was about 19 micrograms per deciliter. So that's about seven or eight times greater than the background levels that we see here in the U.S. among children. And for a long time, we've been tracking the export of used lead batteries from the U.S. and noticed a significant rise starting around 2007, 2008. Anybody know what happened in 2007? For the first time in over 30 years, the Environmental Protection Agency lowered the ambient air standard for lead under the Clean Air Act. And this was going to require significant investment on the part of lead battery recyclers to upgrade their plants to meet this new standard. Many of them are still in that process because there's a phase-in period. But coincidentally, lead battery exports to Mexico shot off. The largest lead battery recycler producer in the world built a huge new plant in Mexico and started exporting there to Mexico from the U.S. Oops. And through publicly available information under the toxic release inventory in the U.S. and its equivalent in Canada and Mexico, we're able to compare the performance of these plants across these three countries. And you can see that plants of comparable size in Canada and the U.S. are releasing way fewer emissions than plants in Mexico. This is pretty much across the board. We see Mexican plants at 20 to 30 times higher emissions than what we see in the U.S. And in the case of Johnson Controls, the world's largest lead battery company, they have just completed and started a brand new recycling plant in South Carolina this year. And they are running a plant in Mexico where about half of the exports from the U.S. Go. And that plant is putting out 33 times more lead than their new plant in South Carolina. So last year we put out a report on the export of lead batteries called Exporting Hazards, and we found substantial differences in environmental, occupational, and public health standards that apply to lead battery recycling in North America. We found that exports of used lead batteries to countries with weaker environmental regulations are increasing rapidly, and that emissions in places like Mexico are resulting in health impacts that are completely avoidable. And if anything, this trend has continued to this day, as we see with the newer 2010-2011 data that we're able to get. As a result of this report, the New York Times picked this up and did a front page story on this in December of last year. And the Commission on Environmental Cooperation, which is a framework organization entity under NAFTA, made up of the three ministries of health with U.S., Canada, and Mexico, have initiated a thorough investigation on transboundary shipments of used lead batteries and on the status of the recycling industry. And they issued a draft report last month and are planning to complete their investigation and issue report by the end of the year, which we think will very well outline the situation and hopefully drive Mexican policy to clean up their act and to begin to crack down on this very polluting industry. Our organization is somewhat unique in that we also work with industry to try to make things better. Our solution for the lead battery manufacturing issue has been to develop a certification standard for battery companies that meet specific emission targets and agree to take back their used batteries for proper recycling. This would be enforced against a specific standard with annual third-party audits, and then companies that meet the standard could put this eco label on their products. We think a similar approach is also needed to address the recycling side of the industry. But as has been mentioned in the introduction, we're also working on global lead paint market, which is a huge and growing industry around the world. The paint market is divided roughly in half between the architectural, residential paints, if you will, the paints that we see in offices and homes, versus industrial paints, which cover everything else, your paints on your automobiles, products, and roads and bridges and the like. And most of the lead that we see in the paint in developing countries is in the oil-based paints. And in every developing country that's been looked at in the last 5 years, in about 40 countries to date, 30 to 40 countries, about 50 to 80% of those paints in those countries contain lead at levels that far exceed the U.S. Guidelines. And although the lead-based paint portion is not growing relative to the water-based paints, because this industry is growing so rapidly, particularly in Asia, the oil-based segment is also growing over the past 10 years by about 20%. So the problem is growing quite rapidly. Which brings up the question, do we need lead in paint? Well, back in 1848, a publication told us what the available substitutes are, and guess what? We're still using those same substitutes. In 1921, the International Labor Organization, still under the League of Nations at that time, enacted an international restriction on the use of white lead. And, of course, we know that there are substitutes for all uses of lead in paints. So why must we act? Because this is a growing threat to public health. If we don't do anything about this problem, go away, in 5 years it will double. In India, the per capita paint consumption is 1/20th of that in the U.S., and in China, it's about 1/10th of the level in the U.S., and the paint companies know this, and they are pushing their products in that part of the world and expecting significant growth in their industry over the next decade. Unless we act now, it's going to cost billions of dollars to deal with the legacy of lead paint throughout the world. So our response has been to help launch a global alliance to eliminate lead paint, which is housed at the United Nations Environment Program and the World Health Organization. Although the APHA voted to take out lead from paints used for homes, I could tell you that over 100 countries voted to eliminate lead in all paints, both industrial and architectural paints. So this is a huge driver for this process globally, and I'm on the steering committee for this global alliance. All of you are invited to join as with your organizations or as individuals. There's a process on the website to join this process, to join this alliance. So in the absence of regulation, because almost no developing country outside of Sri Lanka has a regulation on lead in paint, we're asking companies to voluntarily reformulate and to eliminate lead from their products. And we're also working to develop a certification program for lead in paints to provide consumers with the information they need in purchasing new paints, that there would be a logo on the paint can telling them that the level is below the U.S. Acceptable limit. When will we ever learn? Benjamin Franklin wrote a letter on lead poisoning back in 1786, concluding by saying, "You will observe with concern how long a useful truth may be known and exist before it is generally received and practiced on." And I think nowhere is this more true than in looking at the global lead poisoning epidemic we're now facing. Thank you. We'll open it up for questions. It's a mixture of local companies and multinational companies. For example, we've been working in Cameroon in Africa, and the largest paint company in that country, it controls half the market share or so, is a U.S. company. And in that case, 80% of their paints were very high in lead. And, this is just in the last couple of years, not 25 years ago. So we're still fighting that battle even with the U.S. companies. The largest paint company in the world is Alco Noble, based in Holland. And as far as we could tell, they are not using lead in their affiliates anywhere in the world. But there's a lot of local companies all over the world, of course, that we're working with. Yes? No, actually, I think it's very similar. The German Environmental Protection Agency published a report of this committee that they have, which is somewhat equivalent to the ACLIP here, providing some guidance, with a review of the literature and providing some guidance on how to look at lead levels. What was different about that process is they had a reference value both for adults and for children, whereas the CDC doesn't address adults, at least the childhood-lead poisoning part, does not address adult-lead poisoning. But they also used a reference value approach. Of course, they were using German data, not U.S. data, so their numbers are a little different. And they didn't use the 97.5. They used, I think, the 95th percentile, so that's also a little different, if I'm not mistaken. But the general framework is the same. Yes? I'm sorry, can you speak up a little? It's so loud coming from next door. Right. So the question is, you know, how do practitioners going to deal with this new guidance from CDC? And there's a few things. One is, now it's more and more apparent that you can't just say your child's fine. You know, it used to be if your kid was less than 10, don't worry about it. Or even better yet, we'll call you if your child is overexposed, but don't call us. You know, and we would only call if a kid was above 10. So the first thing is get the information out there. And one of the things we said in our report is that that process should even start, you know, during pregnancy, that the information has to be given to mothers, that should use that information and looking at their housing and their environment and other potential sources. So it has to start really early, but it should continue after the child is born at the pediatric office. They should understand that the most important thing is reducing exposures in their immediate environment. And, you know, there should be testing and the results should be reported. It does matter if your child is at 1 or at 9. And so the parent should be informed of that result. And, you know, those are some simple things that can be done. Do you want to add to that, Dave?
I mean, I think what she's asking is, what's the time frame, right, that you follow up?
That is in there.
Yeah, I guess we didn't go through that.
We didn't go through it.
Yeah, it is in the document, so you can look at follow-up period. But the bottom line is that the repeated testing likely should follow whatever was done to reduce exposures. And it's possible, after all, if you think about it, that an exposure source could be missed, right? And so the follow-up monitoring is important because if they do, for example, they correct a lead paint hazard, but a substantial part of that individual child's exposure came from another house or from a ceramic dinnerware, you would find that out because the blood lead level might not come down. And that would be a follow-up trigger. But I don't recall offhand what the follow-up period is. Do you? But it's in the document. I'll look it up.
Yeah, it is in the document. It is online.
The other thing is that CDC is aware that they have to operationalize this. So there has to be, you know, an operational document. This was more of a theoretical construct, if you will, the shift from level of concern to reference value. Operationalizing it is pretty key. Well, that's what we had with the level of concern. Normal was considered 10. And so physicians in some cases said, if your child's blood lead was 9, they would say he's normal. Well, it's clearly not normal if the average is 1.2 or something like that, right? 9 times over. So that's going away.
Gone away.
It's already gone away. Right.
So is the CDC in the process of developing an action?
Well, I can't speak for CDC, but let's face the harsh reality here. You know, $2 million, which is what they got last year, that's not even enough to pay their staff. So, you know, I mean, it's recognized that there's a need out there. The question is, who's going to do it? And these financial impacts have an effect. There's very few staff left in that branch now. So I can't tell you, standing here today, when they're going to issue it. And it may fall to local jurisdictions or other entities to figure out how we're going to operationalize all of it. Not a happy answer, is it? But I think that's the reality.
Yes. What's most persuasive in developing countries? Well, I think it's very similar to here. You know, people care about their kids, and nobody wants to poison their child. And so as soon as children's health is on the table, I think there's a huge outcry and a huge concern. And so I think that's, you know, that's a lot of the messaging. And, of course, that's why, you know, the lead paint issue is getting, you know, attention wherever it's raised. Yes.
Interagency staff body, which you could probably talk about more than I could, but it's a staff level body, and the president's task force, despite the fact that President Obama did renew it, it has not met at the cabinet level. And when I was with the federal government, that was important, because if that didn't happen, then you'd go to meetings where staff sits around the table and they talk about what each other's doing. But if there's a cabinet level meeting, then each of the staff people in those respective agencies have to figure out, well, what can my boss take to that meeting? And that really did work. I didn't really understand it at the time, how important that was. So the fact that there hasn't been an interagency high-level meeting in this administration is telling. And that's partially, I think, why we're in this fix. It hasn't received the kind of high-level attention that it really needs to have. So the answer is yes, there's an interagency body. They continue to meet. I think it's called Healthy Homes Work Group or something like that. But it's more needs to happen, and I think in the short term it has to be continued pressure to either the EPA administrator and the HHS secretaries. Those two people chair that president's task force, and we continue to try and work to encourage them to actually meet. And those are public meetings. The press comes, and there's significant coverage. But, yeah. I mean, the other thing that should happen, just to finish, is the goal should be reset. I mean, we did have a goal for 2010. We didn't make it. And I've asked agencies, well, since we didn't make it, let's think about what we need to get from now to maybe 2015 or 2020, I suppose. But let's reset that goal. And then it's very compelling. If you set a goal and then you figure out what the costs are to meet that goal, Congress finds that pretty compelling. And I think the same recipe should be done again. Now, obviously, these are different budget climates, and I, you know, we all get that. But we're not really – I'll share this story. When I briefed President Bush's first HUD secretary, I said, this president's task force report indicates that the lead poisoning prevention budget at HUD needs to go from $75 million to $230 million a year. And initially, he said, oh, no, there's no way that that's going to increase that much, because back then they were doing zero-based budgeting. But then he paused for a minute and he said, well, HUD's total budget is $35 billion a year, and you're asking for an extra $150 million or whatever a year. That's a drop in the bucket. And so he backed up, and he actually became a pretty good supporter. And I think trying to find a way to make sure that this becomes a nonpartisan issue, which is what it has historically been, is still important. And we need to identify folks on both sides of the aisle to back it.
I was just going to add to your question that the ACLIP committee is meeting next month, in November, in a few weeks, and they've invited all of the agencies to come in and explain what they're doing in response to this guidance. So it's everything from HUD to FDA are showing up, and we'll get a much better sense of what's happening, if anything. So I think we're out of time, but certainly we're available if there's additional questions. So please come on up, and thank you all for attending.